Okay, so after introducing Espen Andersen, for the one of you who are not familiar with him, and after boringly repeating the same stuff for the other people who are really familiar with it, we engage more in something which I think it's more interesting for some, meaning applying new methodological devices to an old debate and trying to see how to solve some of the issues I've pointed out in the previous session, move on, and then, move on to the most advanced method with Mark later on. And in the middle, we would have also an open space for people to discuss the research. So we try to continue on this work. Again, this example is an illustration from our work, but this technique in particular, and the range of techniques we are discussing, they can definitely be used in a lot of comparative research. So the session will be divided in three parts. So first of all, discussing the methods that have been used in this typology business, as somebody called them. Our application, so our MCA and applications to different type of typologies, and we will see why we have structured different type of typologies by using different indicators. And finally, we will go to the conclusions, and we will open to the session of this afternoon. So we come back to a slide I've already shown you, but this time we will go through that in much more detail. So there are three main quantitative typologies used in the welfare typology business, and on top of that, there is one I don't describe here, but which is not really quantitative, but it has a similar approach, which is the QCA method that Charles Regan used in an article in 1994 to classify countries looking at pension system. However, what we have here is the three main typologies and the three main methods that have been used to verify Espen Andersen or to propose different typologies in the literature. So first of all, we have descriptive statistics, and we will see that descriptive statistics has been used in two different way, Espen Andersen way and another one by using four quadrants, and we will see what are the limits and the interesting puzzle proposing by this method. Among the most important people using this typology, of course, this method, of course, Espen Andersen, and then Castles, as we were discussing with Chris before, who talking about family of welfare state, used descriptive statistics in a different way from Espen Andersen to categorize country. Then we have cluster analysis that we will see has been used in three ways. I don't know how many of you are familiar with cluster analysis, but it's a very, very simple technique. It's rather easy to run even with SPSS. However, it proposed a lot of challenges from the point of view of the theoretical understanding and the way it has been used. And we will see how it has been used in this business, why, and what are, again, the limitations of it. Then we will discuss principal component analysis, which is the third technique that has been used in this business, and we will see again why principal component analysis constitute a very important advancement in this business, however, didn't solve certain problems that we will deal with by using multiple correspondence analysis. As Latin people say, repetita iuvant, so I'll go again and repeating what the decommodification means. From a bit of a broader perspective to then introduce what we are doing. As I was telling you in the previous section, social stratification is very hard to measure. You have only a couple of empirical articles that use social stratification as an indicator, and because it's harder to gather the indicators and come up with the real indicators, and also because many people in the literature believe the decommodification principle is more interesting to categorize country. In this work, we will discuss the decommodification and then another principle, which is the one of defamiliarization that Espen Andersen didn't consider in his 1990 book, but it did include in a following work after the criticism of feminists. So for Espen Andersen, decommodification is politics again, is how much, in a sense, the system, how much politics is able to stand against the market. As I was telling you before, this is the title of a very famous Espen Andersen 1985 book, so before the three wars of welfare capitalism, Espen Andersen, taking back the framework of Walter Korpi, elaborate on it, saying, a welfare state system is generous when it's able to struggle against the strength of the market. And therefore, this is attached at an individual level to the concept of decommodification we were talking about before, because the strongest the political system, politics is against the market, the more people are decommodified and their well-being doesn't depend from their ability to be on the labor market or to be employed. So again, decommodification refers to the degree to which individuals or families can uphold a socially accepted standard of living independently of market participation. So again, very interestingly, even inside decommodification, there is a macro level, which is the one of politics against market, and there is an individual level, which is the level of well-being of people people can afford without being directly employed. The most interesting criticism of Espinandes and classification based on decommodification came from Claire Bamber and Lyle Scruggs in the same issue of Journal of European Social Policy in 2006. They've basically recalculated Espinandes and decommodification index, showing that the results were quite different. So basically, by applying the same principle of Espinandes, they've shown that probably Espinandes misclassify some country according to decommodification. We will see that in detail. Again, how we measure decommodification before we go into the analysis. So always remember to be clear with your indicators. When you do comparative research, I believe it's very important to be very clear and transparent on what you've done before you dive into the analysis. And very often this doesn't happen in the literature. So in order to be clear with you, I iterate again how the decommodification index has been used by Espinandes and how we use it. So the decommodification index has been used by Espinandes with descriptive statistics. So basically what he has done, he considered the cash transfer only, as we were saying, in unemployment protection, pension, and sickness. And as indicators, they use the eligibility rules and restrictions of entitlements, meaning who are the people who can get that and how, and the duration of it. Then the levels of income replacement, which he counted twice. So Espinandes weighted the level of income replacement twice compared to the other indicators in his decommodification index because he believed that this was the most important thing to account for. And finally, the duration. So how long this benefit was given for to the average production worker into certain condition. Each indicator was attributed a score from 1 to 3, and the score to 1 to 3 was given according to the distance of one standard deviation from the mean. So basically, Espinandes calculate the mean of each indicator and then divided countries in three groups. We will see that this procedure has a lot of problems and bring us in a lot of measurement error and biased judgment. So, first of all, Espinandes and decommodification index is limited because it's based on an additive measurement which increase what we call measurement error, and we will see how we can cope with it. It forced the classification of 18 countries in three groups. Because if, you know, I challenge you to calculate the average of a distribution, put plus and minus one standard deviation and come up with a different classification, so with more than three groups, it's impossible. It is a static snapshot. So Espinandes picked up the data in 1980 and defined the world according to the empirical work he did for 1980 data. There is an arbitrary classification of some country because both Scruggs and Bamber came up with something different by using the same numbers, the same data. There is the problematic assumption of the average production worker that we will see. It would be a constant leitmotif of this seminar. And there was a lack of transparency. So Espinandes used the social citizenship data set, which was not publicly available. And even today, these data are available until 1995, not afterwards. And there is an updating of this data set that is done by Joachim Palme and Walter Korpi. However, these data are not publicly available. Therefore, you know, a lot of people had problems with that. And in fact, Scruggs reproduced Espinandes data set, which is the one we have used and updated for our analysis. So descriptive statistics, just to go back to what we were saying before, so all this group of people use descriptive statistics in this way. And I described the way Espen Andersen used it, but descriptive statistics has been used also by Castle in a different way. So what, for example, Castle and Bonoli have done. So they classified countries into two axes, so building up a matrix and saying, you know, I don't know, looking at the level of expenditure, for example, and putting on the other axis the benefit equality, they put countries into four spaces. However, as we will see, this way of thinking has forced typologies rather than a threefold in a fourthfold world, which, for example, was functional to Castle to project his words, was functional to Bonoli to show that there was a Mediterranean model, and so forth. But again, as much as for Espen Andersen, this methodology is arbitrary. It imposed cutoff points. Where is high and low level of expenditure? How we decide what is high and what is low? You know, it was kind of left to the researcher. So we accept the utility of Espen Andersen framework. I preached in the previous session about the greatness of this ideal typical construction. But from a methodological point of view, discounting for the fact that this is a book written in the 1990s, we should never forget that. So 20, 21 years, 22 years ago. However, the methodology was not the best one, the best we could have got. So people evolved. People say, okay, descriptive statistics, cool, but let's do something more. Let's do something different. And they brought in cluster analysis. I mean, if you want to cluster countries, cluster analysis seems to be a natural avenue, a normal way of coping with classifications. So first of all, what cluster analysis is. Cluster analysis is not a single technique. Sometimes people don't consider that much. But cluster analysis is a family of algorithms in order to cluster countries, but very different algorithms. And by using very different algorithms, we can get very different results. So cluster analysis is not a single method, as we will see, is principal component analysis or multiple correspondence analysis, but it's a family. It's a family of methods which go under the same level. What is the advantage compared to descriptive statistics? The data are grouped on the basis of a range of indicators selected by the researcher. So basically, there are not these very strong cutoff points, as we have seen for Espen Andersen and the standard deviation, but the indicators are pulled together, and then we come up with a picture, with a classification that we will see. The general aim of every cluster analysis is to see, to put together countries that are similar to a different level, and we will see that one can pick up different level of similarities. There are three types of cluster analysis that have been used in the welfare typologies literature, in the welfare state literature. First of all, the hierarchical cluster analysis, which basically starts from scratch, from an inductive, complete inductive perspective, plot the countries, and by amalgamation, we get to a certain number of clusters that we can decide. We will see a picture. At the moment, it might seem a bit more complicated than it is. It is really simple. So basically, hierarchical cluster analysis works in this way. So you have, by amalgamation, the number of classes get progressively reduced. So if we stop at the first level of cluster analysis, we will see that there are no clusters. Then progressively, countries start to cluster together. Then progressively, clustering more, until then we can get that there is only one group of country. We will see which are the problems with this in a moment. The second method is the key means cluster analysis, which force the number of classes. So basically, we pre-establish how many classes we have. However, as you can quickly see, if we do that, we have implicitly the same problem we had with descriptive statistics. We say we want 3 words, 4 words, 5 words. You know, we impose an arbitrary number of clusters into the way we build the typologies. And then there have been people who've been using them together. So first they've done a hierarchical cluster analysis by seeing how many classes there were, more or less, and then trying different models with different forcing the number of classes by doing 5, 6, or 7 typologies and see where there was the best fit. I particularly refer to a Yangoff article, 2001, published in the Journal of European Social Policy. So it's in that. So for example, the way Shalev illustrates cluster analysis in his revisional methods is that if we pick up this level we have three classes. However, as I was saying before, we can pick up here, we can pick up here, we can pick up here. Nobody tells us what is the level of detail we want and how we want to run this cluster analysis. So limits of cluster analysis. As I was saying, the evaluation of welfare generosity remains arbitrary because we can decide where we want to stop the amalgamation of this cluster and decide how many of them are there. And in a discussion I had with Mark, you know, Mark was arguing, yeah, fair enough. If we stop at the first level, we have no clusters. If one want to be very picky in the analysis. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so basically, again, let's assume for the sake of simplicity that we have the same as Pin Anderson indicators. What basically cluster analysis does, it tells you which are the country of the closest values in the single indicator. So according to the pension, the level of replacement rates, whatever duration and waiting period for pension and employment protection, and sickness, the countries cluster into a certain way. And of course, the more you go further, the more you put together countries that are different. So if you really want to show a strong cluster, it should be the first one, the second one, the very close one, because these are the countries who are really close, really similar. Therefore, it's one stop at the first level, you will see the countries at the end of the day are not that similar, or one could argue that they're very similar if your level of comparing them, of abstraction, is very high. So, but this is a good point, Robert, to highlight that cluster analysis is really subjective. It's really, you know, driven by the way the researcher wants to stop as a level of similarity. So in this case, the evaluation of welfare generosity remains arbitrary. There are standardization issues. This is very interesting because I haven't talked much about it, but there are different types of cluster, and everybody in the welfare typology business uses a particular type of algorithm to calculate cluster analysis because it's the one that SPSS uses. And, you know, it's a default option in SPSS, but you can choose different ones. And you will see that by using different type of standardization, the classes are completely different. So Shalev highlights that this is a bit, it's a bit tricky. Again, the selection of the best clustering is subjective according to the level of similarity we stop to. The analysis is unstable. By using different algorithms, things can be very different. The models are really static. So you cannot see with cluster analysis if countries move. You can do 30 cluster analysis, but you cannot really see clearly if countries move, if it became more similar to something else or not. And we will see that this is one of our problems when we look at the evolution of the welfare state over time. And the assumption of the average production worker in all the models that have been used with cluster analysis has not been challenged. So again, we keep carrying this big elephant in the room, which is the assumption of the average production worker. And also, we added up this criticism. This method is theoretically underspecified. In a sense, there is no indication and no way of seeing how this clustering links to Espin Anderson. So how the political movements are there, how do we do that? Some people have argued that by imposing 3 words, 4 words, you can do that. However, there is no theoretical basis for doing it in cluster analysis. Therefore, we remain trapped in the same problem we had with descriptive statistics, so the same problem with Espin Anderson. So Espin Anderson divided the 3 words by using standard deviation and average. Here, the number of words is determined by where the researchers stop in looking at the level of similarity. Therefore, cluster analysis helps in the sense because it's a better way of putting together many indicators than it is descriptive statistics. It reduces probability of measurement error, but it leaves us with a lot of the problems that were there with descriptive statistics. Then principal component analysis, which I believe was a great advancement in this business compared to cluster analysis. Because principal component analysis has the possibility to reduce a very large number of indicators into two dimensions, so plotting them into a space, and give to you a clear perception of where a country stands if countries are purely part of a model, if they're hybrid or not. I think this is quite interesting. Is that the principal component analysis has been mostly used by Dutch scholars. And we can go back to a point we were discussing before. First of all, Dutch scholars are very interesting normally in quantitative matters in social policy. But secondly, there is one thing. The Netherlands is a hybrid case very often in all the analysis we've done. Therefore, by using a space, it's easier to highlight hybrid cases, to observe, for example, where the Netherlands stands compared to the other countries. And there are a few articles that are of exactly this purpose. So if you look at this one. So, for example, Vroman book, there's a chapter in his book, a book very hard to find. I had to go in the Stockholm Nuffield Library to find this book, but very interesting. So the aim of his comparison is to see where the Netherlands stand. So it is a book about social protection in the Netherlands, which then use principal component analysis to see why Netherlands is a hybrid and where it stands compared to the other country. So I think that this use of principal component analysis, especially from Dutch scholars, is well explained by the fact that you can really look at the space and plot a hybrid case. And for Dutch scholar being particularly interested in this peculiarity of the Netherlands was quite interesting. There have been other people who have been picking up the particularity of the Netherlands without using very sophisticated techniques, but you know, showing that into a space is a good way of illustrating it. But the things we like about principal component analysis, I believe, and we think it's useful in this business, again, to go back to the idea of taxonomy and parsimony, is that by plotting countries on two dimensions, it's easy to draw conclusion from where they are. So, you know, by having two comprehensive dimensions of these indicators, it's easy to portray or try to portray a reality. So if we look at practically, this is what Michael Shalev has run. He ran a principal component analysis. And what he has done, he has taken social stratification indicators, the one that Espin Andersen used, exactly the same data of Espin Andersen, and he ran a principal component analysis, coming up with two factors. One that he called institutionalism factor, and the other one that he called corporatism factor. Interestingly, now we can go back to a bit of history of the way the three worlds have been conceived. This goes back to Titmuss' idea of welfare state. So, in a sense, you know, the corporatist factor tells you how much a country is Christian democratic, between brackets, so how much a country is based on a social insurance system. And the institutionalist factor tells you more about how much a country is universal. So in a sense, what you do here, you say from a certain point to another, you have a continuum between non-universal, extremely universal. So US and Sweden, just to go back to the familiar monodimensional graphs I was showing you, but better than what I was doing in the previous lecture, you have also the other dimension. So how much corporative a country is. So for example, countries who are in this space, they have a very fragmented pension system for different types of civil servants. Yesterday, Martin was talking about it, right? That the civil servant is a different thing in France, in Italy, or in general in continental Europe than it is in the United Kingdom or than it is in Australia, New Zealand. And this is shown by the fact, if we take the example of France, that everybody has a different type of pension. Think about what in France is called régime spéciaux. So certain categories of civil servants, notably people working in the railroad, had a different type of pension entitlements. So the more the system was fragmented, the more the system recalled the corporatist idea portrayed by the Bismarckian model. So to make a long story short, what is useful in principal component analysis is that he put all these indicators we've been talking about. So Espin Andersen had eight different indicators, eight different dimensions of social stratification in a two-dimensional space. And this two-dimensional space tell us how much a country is universal, and how much a country is corporatist. So I think that is a very good way of portraying it, is a less arbitrary way of doing it than the one Espin Anderson has used and the one the people who use cluster analysis have done. So at this point, you might ask, okay, so why do we bother using another method if this is good? There is an however, as usual, in the application of all these methodologies. First of all, principal component analysis assume that the variables are continuous, meaning they assume that there is a normal distribution of the variables, or that you have a distribution which is quite uniform. However, we will see that this is a very, very strong assumption, because most of the indicators... Sorry, could you show? No, no, thank you. We see that many of the variables we use in our analysis are not continuous. And I will show you some example of it. So if we pick up the waiting period, for example, so this is the number of days people need to wait in order to get unemployment benefits once they get unemployed. You can see that this is not a continuous variable, but this is a very spiky distribution. And if we want to correctly plot our analysis, we cannot use a technique that assumes that this variable is continuous, because this variable is not. So in this variable, you have the majority of observation is you have zero, so you don't have any waiting period. Then it's a week, 7 days, and then 2 weeks, 14 days. But the other, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 days is not there. There are not many observations. Therefore, by treating this variable, we could have done the same example with duration. The duration is very often. You have 2, 3, 4 categories are very often there. We see that these variables are not continuous. Therefore, principal component analysis, very good technique, plotting stuff in a space, showing very clearly the words. However, it assumes the continuous variables. Other very strong assumption, it requires that the variables are uncorrelated. So the two dimensions, it assumes that the two dimensions we are discussing about, so the institutional is just to go back to Shalev. So that these two dimensions and the indicators in these two dimensions are completely uncorrelated, which is another very strong assumption. We see with MCA that we don't have to do it. And another problem is that generally requires a large sample size to work. And again, sometimes we have very restricted samples in this business. There are people who have done principal component analysis by using only 18 cases. Now, one can say that things work anyway. However, in theory, to have a principal component, to run a principal component analysis, we need to have a certain number of cases per number of variable we are imputing in the system. Therefore, despite principal component analysis being a very good method, in my opinion, to visualize and put on a bi-dimensional space Espin Anderson typologies, it doesn't really fit into the data we have. Yesterday we were talking a lot about it, and I think it's important to go back to this point, that we can do all analysis we want, but if our data are not fine for what we are doing, we are really misinterpreting somehow reality. Therefore, we decided to move on from principal component analysis to multiple correspondence analysis. So a bit about multiple correspondence analysis. I don't know how many of you are sociologists in this room, but the one of you who are probably familiar with La Distinction, with the sociological work of Bourdieu, that in 1979 come up with the use of multiple correspondence analysis. What was the need for it? Bourdieu was fed up, as many social scientists, with this idea, we were talking about it yesterday, of causal nexuses. So the fact that the majority of the work of social scientists, of sociologists, was looking at the causes of things rather than describing them first into a proper way. So multiple correspondence analysis was a simple way to put people into a space according to their taste in the specific case of la distinction. And what we taught by using multiple correspondence analysis, it was an interesting idea to apply the same principle to welfare state typologies. So what we have done, we have used MCA rather than applying that to people, as Bourdieu has done, as most of sociologists do. You can find in England very interesting work by people like Mike Savage and Alan Wood on this field, on the field of kind of taste and consumption. We've applied that at a macro level. So we say, why we don't plot country into space, as people have done with the PCA, by using the advantages of multiple correspondence analysis. And why we believe the multiple correspondence analysis is good. So first of all, differently from descriptive statistics, you can exploit all indicators contained in the decommodification index without increasing measurement error and forcing countries into a certain number of words, as descriptive statistical classes analysis do, as PCA does as well. It is parsimonious as much as principal component analysis because it generates a space underlined by two dimensions and four geographical spaces that can be commented, as Bourdieu has done in his book. However, as I was telling you before, differently from PCA, it allows us to plot variables that do not have really continuous distribution. Therefore, it allows us to consider the fact that these variables are spiky and transform these variables from continuous variables into categorical variables. That is what they really are. And again, this is the example I was showing you. So rather than doing this, it's much better to divide this space in three categories rather than running it as a continuous variable. So how we adapted multiple correspondence analysis from the sociological type of analysis that Bourdieu did to welfare regime theory. So first of all, we have recorded all continuous count and ordinal variables into the models into quartiles in order to avoid the problem associated with poorly distributed variables, as I've been saying just a minute ago. We interpreted geographical spaces emerging from the cloud of indicators and the position of each country by relating them to welfare regime theory. This requires a bit of explanation. I will go into more detail, but I anticipate that. So MCA works at two levels. So you have two graphs. On one graph, you have a cloud of indicators. So all the indicators we have, the variables divided in quartiles are plotted into one space. That is... Here we are. So you have a first graph that come up. So in this graph, you don't see any country. But what you really see is that here we have all the variables which are indicated by symbols. The number one means lowest quartile. And number four means the top quartile in our distribution. So the MCA distribute the countries according to the way these categories are positioned, all these different variables. And then if we go... Here we are. And how we define the characteristic of a country is by triangulating. So you calculate an area. You can look at an area. So, for example, let's argue that here there is, just for the sake of simplicity, high unemployment. So high unemployment protection. So very generous benefits. Here there is a very long duration of sickness benefits. And here there is a very short waiting period for unemployment to get unemployment benefits. The country will be here, and the characteristic of the countries plotted here will be determined by the triangulation of these three variables. So if you go there, okay, if you go to this, for example, the country that is here, the space will be determined by these three variables. So level one in sickness, like six in sickness duration, level three, third quartile in this, and first one in the other dimension. And the country will be put there. Therefore, differently from PCA, we don't discuss the positioning of the country according to the two dimensions, but we discuss the positioning of each country according to the geographical space that this country occupies. Now you understand that this is a disadvantage from the point of view of parsimony, but it's quite interesting because it allows us to describe the characteristic of each single country and looking at countries which are closer or have similar characteristics inside this space. So rather than talking about wards or classes, we really talk about spaces occupied by countries. And we will see that this is more or less what we get. We'll go back to these slides, but the things I was showing you before, so this space is exactly the same as this one. So you can imagine that here there are all the indicators you can see in the other space, and the countries are plotted according to this. And we will see why this is interesting and useful. So first of all, recorded variables, interpretation of geographical space. But what is useful about MCA and convinced us to use that technique is that with MCA we can plot variation over time in a graphical way. So multiple correspondence analysis allow us to look how welfare state have changed or if they moved. And we will do that by looking at the evolution of welfare state for each decade. So what we have done to do that, we have run two models. The first one including all indicators for 30 years. So for the 30 years that we have available data from the SCRAGS dataset and see the absolute position of countries. And then we have run another model in which these values are calculated for each 10 years in order to see the movement of the countries. You will see the one I'm talking about, it's easier to be looked upon rather than simply be explained. But I think it's interesting to get first all the principles in a kind of deductive way, as Max Weber would have done, and then we go to the practice of the data and we go back then to the meaning of it. Now, what are the methodological weaknesses that have not been addressed in this welfare typology business that I've been discussing at the end of the previous literature, at the previous session, the one I've called Regimes Futures? We had three problems. First of all, the assumption of stability of welfare regimes over time. The idea that welfare state is something that doesn't change, as Espin Anderson has portrayed in the 1990 book, it basically assumes that political movements do not change. However, very famous political scientists like Martin and David Rueda and other people have argued that social democracy today, in the 2000s, is very different from what social democracy was in the 1970s. That the impact on social policy of the Labour Party run in the 1970s was very different from the new Labour of Tony Blair and his impact on social policy. And it actually was closer, social democracy, to conservative parties. Therefore, from the point of view of political science, one might argue that it's interesting to look at the movement and if there is a shift. Because if political movements are changing, their impact on the way social policy is structured will change. However, here, we need to importantly remember that the impact of political movements, it's something that goes in the long term. So we will see in certain of our models, we cannot pick up probably this change because the impact of the different type of policy that the Labour Party has done in social policy doesn't show up in our data. And maybe it doesn't show up in our average production worker. Just to go back to our usual example of Germany. We don't pick up with the average production worker the problem of the arts reform. The arts reform is a clear change of the SPD, of the Social Democratic Party. However, in the way we portray the welfare regime in this model, it doesn't show up. It shows up only partially into certain dimensions, but it doesn't in the replacement rates and in other things. The second problem that we had to address is the one of the work-welfare nexus. So, Espin Anderson has mainly focused on pension, unemployment, and sickness, but he didn't focus on the family dimension. And what we do in our article, we say, okay, so we do the models as Espin Anderson did, cool, pension, unemployment, sickness, that's the result. But then, we need to consider two things. First of all, that the current structure of pension, so the output data we have for pension, the replacement rate we have for pension, doesn't reflect the generosity of the pension system for people today. So for the young citizen of today, they will be retired in 30 years. But it reflects the generosity of the system of 40 years ago. It reflects the generosity of the system for my mother, not for me. Therefore, if we want to look at the transformation of the welfare state, we might don't want to look at the pension system, but only focus on the things that are changing the most, which is unemployment protection and family policy. And we will see that the words of welfare capitalism look through the lens of Espen Andersen, through the decommodification index, and the one look at unemployment protection and defamiliarization are very, very different. And we will see that the second one is less stable, is evolving much more. However, with these models I'm showing you, we still do not deal with the big elephant in the room, which is the average, the problem of the average production worker. Therefore, what we do is like kind of, no, we are really discussing these sessions in the same way that we have approached the problem. So we have approached the problem by first solving the idea of evolution over time, then integrating different dimensions, but then, you know, we add up and try to add up how to deal with the integration of macro and micro and the average production worker, and we are still trying to solve that, and God knows if we will be able to do it. So don't worry about these slides. This is, again, it's a slide that is used mainly for when you will read the slides, if you will have the interest to look at that back again. So what happened here is that we have four different models. So now I will show you four different types of multiple correspondence analysis. In the first one, we use Espen Andersen. We pick up exactly the same indicators that Espen Andersen has used for pension, unemployment protection, and sickness from 1971 until 1999. And we will see what this gives. Then we say, okay, one thing we want to do is to look at the same data. However, we want to look at the evolution over time. Then what we've done, as I was telling you before, we excluded pensions for the reasons I was telling you, and we have run another model by integrating unemployment protection and family policy and see the evolution of it over time. And then we have run separate model for family policy and unemployment protection in order to disentangle with more detail what's happening in these two dimensions, because we will see there is a lot of movement. So, going quickly to Espen Andersen, we run our model, and here I'd say that I had an interesting debate with Robert about that because I put these lines. So, what one could do, you just run this model, you plot countries, and you simply say, countries who are around this area, they have a high level of universalism and generous cash transfers. Of course, what I've done, guided by the deductive framework of Espen Andersen, was to put them together and say, cool, these are the social democratic ones. These are the good crowd. Then here, when you have an intermediate level of universalism and kind of quite generous medium-high cash transfers, you have the Christian democratic countries. Where you have lower level of universalism and cash transfers, you have the kind of liberal. However, as you can see, this cluster is a bit large. So here you have the liberals are closer to the Christian democratic, particularly Italy and Switzerland. And then you have the liberal, like the ones who have kind of less generous provisions. And interestingly, and look how, As I was telling before, the axis cannot be defined because there are so many dimensions that the only things we can do is to define the space. So, to go back here, there are so many indicators that the way we define these spaces is by triangulating the different indicators and seeing the position of the country. So, defining the dimensions is very hard because of the number of indicators we have. I hope it's clear. If you want, we can go more in detail into that in the Q&A session. But very interestingly, for the fun or the supporters of Castles, these are the radicals. This is fun how much it mirrors the geographical position of the countries. They're really far away because they have a medium high level of universalism. So basically, they have not very low, so they have not generous cash transfers as the liberal. However, they are more universal. The means tested is run in a different way, as I was saying before. And this differentiates them. So Castles will be very happy of this picture. It's the addition of the four posts to Espin Anderson. So if we run this model, one could argue that we cannot really put these lines. These lines are arbitrary, that there are big distances here, and that this is close to this one as much as to this one, or whatever you can argue. However, if we plot countries, we have more or less countries gathered around four or five spaces that we can discuss according to the level of universalism, the generosity of cash transfer. As I was telling you, we were not only interested in discussing Espin Anderson, because otherwise we will fall into what somebody was asking before, who cares, right? So redoing and redoing this. But what we tried to do is say, oh, see how much they move. So you have the same graph. So the graph is based exactly about the same dimension. So you can see these figures are the same thing. However, here we can see for each decade how much country move. So just to pick up an example, UK1 means UK 1970s, UK2 is the average of UK 1980s, and UK3 is the average of UK 1990s. What we see here, it's a picture of extreme stability. 15 out of 18 countries do not really move, according to Espin Anderson indicators. In a sense, we say, political scientists, very interesting reflection, Martin, very interesting reflection about the change of political movements. However, in reality, they don't move. Three exceptions to this. First of all, Finland and Norway. For people who have read Stein Kuhle book about historical development of welfare state, this doesn't come to as a surprise. In the 1970s, Norway and Finland were not social democratic welfare state systems. They were much more liberal. And progressively, they moved to the social democratic space. So this jump from Finland 1970s to Finland 1980s and then 1990s doesn't surprise. It's a movement from liberal to social democratic, which is very well accounted in the historical literature. Interesting country, it's the United Kingdom. As you know, there's been something happening here in the 1980s with Margaret Thatcher. What Margaret Thatcher has done is basically reduced the level of universalism of the welfare state in the United Kingdom. And successively, in the third decade, you have the New Labour that played a bit doing another movement. However, if we believe in Espin Anderson for a second again, the United Kingdom, despite moving, it always remained into the liberal zone. So these changes generated by substantive political shift impact on the structure of the welfare state, but not enough to move, to let the country move into a completely different system. So, stability. I'll explain to you how this works. You can skip the slides. And then we go to the second model. Again, as I was telling you before, we took out pension and we remained only with unemployment protection and family policy. This time from the 1980 to 2008. So we have a bit more coverage from the data. And the picture we see is a bit different. It's a bit different because we're looking at different policy. So here we have high generosity of family policy and low conditionality of unemployment protection. Again, the good word, the good ones. So we find already the country we would expect, Sweden, Denmark, and Norway, and there is the addition of France. This is because France has very generous family policy, coming from a long history, coming from De Gaulle and all sorts of things. So it doesn't surprise us that France joined the good crowd when we add up this. What happened here, there's a very strange development in the Christian democratic world. We find Germany, as we would expect, but then we find Netherlands and Finland. Say, that's interesting. However, also this thing is quite explainable. First of all, when you look at family policy, Netherlands is not that generous, as you might expect from knowing the system. Therefore, this put the Netherlands close to their strong male breadwinner model, if we want to use a Jean Lewis expression. And Finland as well, as if you remember, in the graph I was showing you in the continuum, had a very strong Christian democratic component, and this really show up when you put family policy and unemployment protection. And then you have Austria and Italy, who are kind of scattered around in the space for different reasons. Austria, because it doesn't have a very generous unemployment protection system, less generous than Germany, and Italy because of its not very generous family policy. Again, also Japan, standalone in these points with a low generosity of family policies and the kind of medium-high conditionality of unemployment protection. And here, you have finally the liberals come back together. So you have Ireland, United Kingdom, US, New Zealand, and Australia. Although New Zealand and Australia stay a bit apart always, but inside a closer area. This is because in both cases, the generosity of family policy is very low and the replacement rate for unemployment protection is very low. If we look at the movements very quickly, there is a lot of move. I won't go much into the detail of these slides because it's quite hard to understand from this one. And this is why we have run a separate analysis for family policies and unemployment protection. But the only things you need to grasp from these slides, and then you can look at them more accurately in the paper if you want, is that there is a lot of movement. If we consider unemployment protection and family policy, there is much more movement than if we consider the traditional S.P. Anderson indicators, because things have changed quite radically. Oops. And this is my favorite. This is my favorite slide of the talk. What happened here? This is only family policy. Just a quick explanation. Family policy, we have two main type of indicators. One are parental maternal leaves, so leaves. So leaves measured in terms of replacement rates and generosity of the duration of these leaves. And then we have services. So the dimension of how much countries spend for services captured within indicators were calculated from the OECD, calculating the average expenditure for kids below the age of 5. Not a perfect indicator, not at all. Shalev was highlighting in a chat we had that we should have measured the opening hours of kindergarten to see how good services were. However, as you can imagine, this is not very easy to do. It might be very variable into a country. However, this is a rough indication of how much countries invest into childcare, how much childcare is generous for mothers and people. By using this not perfect indicators, we see one thing. This is a really like, you know, a tree, kind of a triangle, a vision of the world, which is like, you know, one would like if believes in evolution and it has a religious faith. Here we have the bad, right? So radical and liberals. Non-comprehensive childcare services and short leave. In certain cases, no leave, like in the United States. And the United States, no move there. So no leave, and very little money, public money invested in childcare service. Here, you have the ugly, which is becoming less and less ugly, however. In this place, you have Christian democratic countries who are the ones who have kind of medium-low comprehensive childcare services, not very high expenditure in childcare service. However, medium long leaves, and quite generous leaves. You know, the model woman stay at home, basically. We give you a decent leave, you can stay at home for 3 years and you're quite happy. So, the Christian democratic paternalistic model. And somebody could say, you know, the feminists might say they're ugly. And here, you know, as I labeled it when I saw this graph first, heaven, right? So the good. Comprehensive childcare and long leave, right? The paradise for family policy and parents. This would be a static vision of reality, but what's happening, and what I like in this graph, is the countries are moving. So the country where liberals, who are liberals, are becoming more and more Christian democratic. So first of all, increasing the leave. Somebody might argue the countries are civilizing. understanding it is good if a mother has a kid, he can stay for 40 weeks at home. Or if the father wants to take time out, he can do that too. And the countries, the Christian democratic countries, are becoming more social democratic. Particularly interesting example of Germany and Austria who are moving here. What's happening is that to the leave, to the traditional long leave, the attention for childcare and childcare services is increasing. And that's what we have called in the paper the Swedenization of family policy, and we plan to write an article about this, just focusing on the structure and the change of family policy. However, there is movement for what we are interested for. And to go back to the question I got from the audience before, the fact we've been playing with these things helped us to see this movement. Very, very famous social scientists like Espen Andersen and Neil Gilbert have published in this field by saying that family policies are not changing that much. The title of Espen Andersen's book is The Incomplete Revolution. By looking at this graph, we might say, yes, the revolution might be incomplete, but it isn't the move. And there is a switch, there is a kind of shift, as we will see with the next graph, from investing in unemployment protection into investing into family policy, which can kind of hit into the same problem sometime, and supporting people into a certain way. So what happened here? In this quadrant, you have medium-high generosity of family policy and high conditionality of unemployment protection. So basically, what's happening here is that the countries are moving in this direction. They are reducing the generosity of their unemployment protection. And that's what Martin called the dual transformation of the welfare state. Dual transformation because it implies less generous unemployment protection, more generous family policy. You see that very clearly in Germany, Netherlands, Italy, Japan, Canada, and other countries. And interestingly, France moved in the opposite direction. Now, if you read, I don't know if you ever do, but the Age of Dualization book, there's a big fight in there, because some people sustain that France is dualizing. My impression, France is not, because the generosity of unemployment protection is not going down. However, family policies are becoming more and more generous. However, the general direction of European countries is a reduction of the generosity of unemployment protection and an increasing generosity of family policy, with peculiar exception. US, no move. So that's what somebody has called dual transformation of the welfare state. I don't know if it's a real dual transformation of the welfare state or whatever it is. However, we see that there is movement, a movement that we couldn't see before with the traditional Espen Andersen indicators. And I conclude, because I think I've been talking too much. What our paper and this session does. First of all, it provides a methodological contribution by discussing previous methods and proposing the advantages of a new method. Substantively, it tested Espen Andersen typology with a better method, in our opinion, and look at the movement over time. Furthermore, it took in consideration to integrate the work welfare and the care welfare next side together by showing that if you look at this dimension, there is much, much more move. However, the issue of the integration between macro and micro remains open, and it will be the theme of the next two sessions run by Mark this afternoon and tomorrow. That's it for today, and we can open the Q&A session. Thank you.